Good morning. So it's good to see council present and the panel as well. I'll have the marshal call the third matter on our argument calendar, and then I'll have a few remarks before we start the argument.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfield, Judge Werke, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Bradfield presiding. Now calling State of Minnesota versus Curtis Allen Anderson, case number A20213.
Right, and counsel, I'll just do a quick check since we're doing this argument by Zoom, just to make sure that everyone can hear each other and that your audio works for us, because that's, of course, very important. So, Ms. Yauch Erickson, do you say Yauch or Yauk?
Yauk.
Okay, very good. Ms. Yauch Erickson, it sounds like I can hear you. You can hear me?
I can hear you, Judge. Good morning.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Good morning. And Ms. Burdorf, if you'd also check your audio and confirm you can hear it.
Hopefully I've unmuted and you can hear me.
Yes. Thank you so much. Okay. So with that, we're ready to begin the arguments. I'll say just a couple of things. I know you know them both. So please identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent. And then please keep your eye on the clock. It should be visible. And I know that both of you know what to do if for some reason you lose connectivity or view of the clock or something like that. So just give us a shout if something goes awry. But we're ready and looking forward to hearing your argument. So, counsel for appellant, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Curtis Anderson. Mr. Anderson has raised two issues for this court's consideration, and this morning I'd like to do three things. First, discuss the evidence that demonstrates that Vanessa Smith alone possessed the drugs in the cooler. Second, discuss what are and are not circumstances proved in this case. And third, explain why Mr. Anderson's jail phone call does not negate the reasonable inference that Ms. Smith alone possessed the drugs. There are many facts, circumstances proved in this record that demonstrate that Vanessa Smith alone by herself possessed the drugs in the cooler. Arguably the most important and compelling fact in this case is that 5 months later, Vanessa Smith did the same thing. She was found in a vehicle in which she was riding as the passenger, a large quantity of methamphetamines, in fact, larger than the amount in this case, was found in a bag with items of her mail, personal items of Ms. Smith's. She was the only one charged in those circumstances. She did this again when Mr. Anderson was not around. That is a compelling fact that demonstrates her sole possession of the drugs on November 7th. But it's not the
so
only.
So who introduced that evidence at trial, counsel?
Mr. Anderson did.
Okay. And so the state did not present that in its case, right?
Did not. No. Okay. I understand respondent agrees that that is a circumstance proved, and that is correct.
And the jury got to hear that circumstance.
They did. Yep. The jury heard and they made a different inference, but it is now incumbent on this court to examine all the possible inferences from the circumstances proved. Certainly one inference is that they jointly possessed these drugs, but because another reasonable inference exists on these facts, that means the state didn't prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and this court must reverse his conviction. Her later possession, 5 months later, of methamphetamines in someone else's car is not the only fact of Ms. Smith's sole possession. The cooler is located between her feet. Ms. Smith has three separate baggies of methamphetamine on her person, one in her pants pocket, one in her purse, one in her coffee mug that she attempts to hide. Also in her purse, we have many implements of drug use and implements of drug sale. The scale found in her purse is an identical match to the scale in the cooler. Ms. Smith testifies she put her day planner in the cooler. She accessed that cooler and she touched the baggies. And this comes from the state. This comes from the state's evidence. Officer Vosacek testifies. When she gave a statement, she admitted, you might find my DNA on those baggies. So she accessed the cooler, touched the baggies. All of those facts together create a reasonable inference from the circumstances prove that she was the only one possessing these drugs. It's important to keep in mind that even in a joint possession case, the state has to prove both parties, or all parties if there's more than two, exercise dominion and control over the contraband. So in order for Mr. Anderson to be guilty of this offense jointly, the state still has to demonstrate that he exercised dominion and control over the cooler, over the drugs in the cooler. I would submit that all of those facts I just mentioned aptly demonstrate and amply demonstrate the only one who exercised dominion and control over that cooler was Ms. Smith. Next, I'd like to discuss with this court what are and are not circumstances proved. We've just touched on, or I've just touched on, many of the circumstances proved. Respondent argues that some of those don't count. Respondent argues that Ms. Smith's testimony, introduced by the defense, none of what she says counts in the circumstances proved. That is wrong. This is a joint possession case. That's the way the prosecutor presented it in opening statement. That's the way the jury was instructed. And that's the prosecutor's theory of the case. They argued to the jury in closing. In fact, it's their only theory of the case. The jury found Mr. Anderson guilty based on a joint possession theory. What that means is every fact, every piece of evidence demonstrating Ms. Smith's possession supports the verdict. It is consistent with the verdict because the verdict was guilty of joint possession. So all of her testimony that indicates that she was affiliated with the cooler, near to the cooler, put her planner in the cooler, that's all consistent with the verdict. Those are.
And then also we have his jailhouse communications. I mean, you know, that's kind of reality. You have to deal with that. What do we do about that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you for bringing that up. That is a circumstance proved. That's a fact in this record. But this court has to look at all of the possible inferences from the totality of all of those facts. Three reasons that that doesn't negate the inference of Ms. Smith's sole possession. First, those statements are made well after the fact. This is not something like an excited utterance made, blurted out as soon as the officer's on the scene, made on the scene, where we'd say there's an indicia of reliability in that statement. This is made hours later after Mr. Anderson knows they've found drugs, sees the drug dog, find the drugs in the car. He's been questioned. He's talked to Ms. Smith. There's no reason to think that his casual conversation with a friend is in any way indicative of what the truth was, what the truth was when they were arrested. Second, what he doesn't say is significant. Again, this is a rather casual conversation with a friend. If those drugs were his and he's feeling like, oh, I might get a lucky break here. They haven't charged us yet, but I might get away with this. His language would be indicative of that. That is not what he says. And thirdly, the third problem with the jail call is that what respondent wants you to do is pretend there's only one inference about that call. The only inference is that it's a guilty mind. That's not the only inference. Maybe when he said she's going to take the charge, maybe he meant take the fall. Maybe he meant they had both been involved and she's taking it, even though somehow, even though she's got a lot of connection to these drugs, she wasn't involved. But there's an additional inference that when he said take, he meant take responsibility. He meant she's going to own up to this because they were her drugs. She's going to take the charge because she's the only one who should have had a charge in the first place. Remember, there have not been charges filed at this point. They've been arrested. They're both in jail, but they don't know what's going to happen. He doesn't know if he's going to be charged with possessing these drugs that weren't his. So when he makes those statements well after the fact in a casual conversation, but doesn't implicate himself, there's multiple inferences about that call. And I would also suggest it's a fact. It's a fact that has to be dealt with. It's a fact this court can rely on. It is one fact. The state has this one fact to indicate that Mr. Anderson perhaps jointly possessed the drugs. It does not somehow outweigh and negate the many, many facts of Ms. Smith's sole possession. Most importantly, that she did the same thing 5 months later when Mr. Anderson wasn't around. I'd like to go back for a moment to the circumstances proved and what are and are not in those circumstances. Ms. Smith's testimony is in. Everything about her subsequent conviction is in. This court can and should rely on those circumstances proved when it is determining what inferences to make about this evidence. But there's another dynamic here in this case. Respondent has suggested that this court can make guesses about what the jury believed or didn't believe, what happened in that jury room, and transform what are really inferences into circumstances proved. That is absolutely not the case. There is no law to suggest that's how we do the circumstantial evidence test in Minnesota. I have been doing this job 7 years. Your honors are very experienced jurists, and I would ask you if you've ever seen an appellate opinion in the state of Minnesota that listed in the circumstances proved the jury believed X or the jury disbelieved Y. I would expect you haven't. I certainly haven't, because that's not the law. Circumstances proved are facts. They come from evidence. What respondent is really suggesting is that there's an inference. There's an inference you can make about what the jury believed and didn't believe. That's certainly true. But what we don't do is take inferences, ideas, unproven notions about what the jury thought and transform them into circumstances proved. They don't go in that pile. They are not evidence. They are not facts. The jury's disbelief.
But so for instance, Smith testified and she said that she didn't know anything about the narcotics in the cooler and that they must have belonged to your client. And yet, for instance, when I looked at the day planner that was found in the cooler with the lottery ticket, she said that was her day planner, but there was no testimony, I don't think. For instance, it said there were dates where it said go to jail. And there was no testimony about whose handwriting it was or no corroboration that she was going to jail on those dates. Nothing to substantiate her testimony that it was her day planner, but she didn't know anything about what was in the cooler. And what I'm getting at is, I don't think the jury believed her. That's pretty unbelievable that your day planner would be in a cooler with meth and you don't know meth is in there.
I agree with Your Honor that they didn't believe that she didn't know about the meth. I disagree that the jury didn't believe her that it was her planner. There is no evidence in the record to the contrary. The handwriting in the planner is different than the handwriting on the lottery ticket, which the state suggested was Mr. Anderson's handwriting. They belong to two different people. If the state wanted to prove that she wasn't in jail on the days noted in the planner, the state should have proved that. They didn't. Instead, her testimony.
She gave very self-serving testimony, it seems.
Oh, I disagree. In fact, when she said, I know nothing about what was in that cooler, she became emotional and was asked why. It's because she's already in prison and she said explicitly on the record, I don't want to get any more time. So it's self-serving in the sense that she's not admitting they're her drugs. Certainly it was. Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not able to hear you.
Sorry, that's what I mean. She is serving her own purposes.
Perhaps, but she's also telling the truth. Well, we don't know whether she's telling the truth or not. Regardless, the circumstance proved is that it's her planner. It's consistent with the verdict. There's no conflicting testimony in the record. It's a circumstance proved that she touched the items in the cooler. It's a circumstance proved that she put her planner in the cooler. That those are the entirety of the circumstances proved about those belongings, whose they were, and where they were in the car. So what we have is this person saying, my stuff is in there, I touched what was in there, and it was at my feet. Those are circumstances proved. Now you can make different inferences from those circumstances proved, but they are facts. They are evidence in the record. The jury made one inference. This court has to examine all the other possible inferences from those circumstances. One inference is that it was only Ms. Smith who was exercising dominion and control over that cooler found in between her feet. That Mr. Anderson, on the contrary, did not exercise dominion and control over that cooler. He says this headphone case is mine and everything in it is mine. That cooler is not mine. We have no facts, no circumstances proved from which the state has been able to make an argument, have any coherent theory about why Mr. Anderson was exercising dominion and control, which is an element they have to prove. So what we have now are a lot of circumstances, including Ms. Smith had the planner, she put it there and she touched the cooler to show she was the only one exercising dominion and control. Again, on appeal, we do not have to disprove a theory of joint possession. I agree, that is one possible inference from the circumstances proved. That's what the jury found. But what this court does is look at everything. Look at everything, keep an open mind about the possible inferences and say, are there any others? Are there any other reasonable inferences inconsistent with guilt? And that's what we have here. A reasonable inference inconsistent with guilt, namely that Vanessa Smith was the only one possessing those drugs. That is the same thing she did 5 months later in someone else's car when she kept the methamphetamine in a different container, also with pieces of her belongings. If the court has no further questions, I would cede the remainder of my time.
I do have one question. You also have appealed the judge not allowing, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, Bozacek or whatever, the officer.
Yes.
And so are you just relying on your brief for that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. We would rely on our brief that the district court erroneously excluded what was a proposed single impeachment question put to the officer. It complied with Rule 608B. It prejudiced Mr. Anderson from its exclusion. It would have gone a long way to undercut Officer Bozacek's damaging testimony, which suggested to the jury that Mr. Anderson was somehow involved, that Mr. Anderson was somehow guilty.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. As soon as the clock is reset, I think we're ready for respondent's argument. Here we go.
May it please the court. My name is Jean Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. This prosecution's evidence in this case was virtually identical to the prosecution's evidence that was presented at the first trial. This court reviewed the sufficiency of that evidence in 2019, and it held that the evidence was more than sufficient to prove that Mr. Anderson constructively possessed the methamphetamine and THC wax in the cooler in his car on November 7th, 2017.
So, counsel, you've said it was virtually the same. Are there some differences? And I guess I'm particularly asking about Ms. Smith's testimony and the evidence offered about, and maybe you meant the state's case was the same, but did the defense offer a different evidence?
I did mean, in fact, the state's case was nearly identical, and the defense offered different evidence in this case. And I will address that happily momentarily, but I do want to just run through very, very quickly what Ms. Yoke Erickson has said repeatedly, that the prosecution presented no evidence suggesting that Mr. Anderson consciously exercised dominion and control over that methamphetamine. And we disagree. There's proximity. It was his car. And although the drugs were found in the passenger compartment, that's within feet of where he is. His personal effect, the lottery ticket, which we will discuss, I assume, again, momentarily when we talk about Vanessa Smith's testimony, the lottery ticket, there's no dispute. It had his name on it and his address. And that was in the bag with the methamphetamine and the THC wax. He admitted that he had marijuana in his Beats head case. And he had these very unique, if you look at the exhibits, you'll see photographs of them, these very unique little silicone containers. He admitted that the Beats container that contained meth or marijuana, a marijuana grinder and a silicone case were his items. I mean, Ms. Yoke Erickson made an argument about Vanessa Smith and what she had, suggesting she was a methamphetamine user. We don't dispute she was a methamphetamine user, but the same exact argument can be made to show that Mr. Anderson exercised dominion and control over that bag because there was marijuana in that bag. There was THC in that bag. He is the person who had the marijuana, not Ms. Smith. So that connection between the drugs in the bag and drugs he admitted owning is strong circumstantial evidence that he exercised dominion and control over the bag where the methamphetamine is found. And then we have the admissions. And the admission, I'm just going to read the whole thing, what he said to a friend. And again, I don't think it needs to be an excited utterance to be reliable. This is a phone call that he made to a friend that presumably he didn't think was going to be recorded or didn't think the police would find. He said, and this is hours after he's arrested. So it's substantially contemporaneous. He said, "I got into a bunch of shit. She's going to take the charge," meaning Vanessa Smith, "because she doesn't have any charges. She's got nothing on her record at all." And later said, "I haven't been charged yet because it's both of us." Both of those, I submit to you, are compelling admissions. there is absolutely no reason that Vanessa Smith would have to concoct a story and take a charge for appellant if he wasn't involved in the crime at all. I mean, that just makes no sense at all. But moving to that, so that is the sum of the state's evidence. This court, as I said, based on that evidence, already found that it was sufficient to support a guilty verdict in this case. The new evidence really is Vanessa Smith's testimony and appellant's testimony. And you've accurately described what Vanessa Smith said. Importantly, she said, the planner and lottery ticket were mine. She didn't say, I did touch the cooler, I handled it. She said, my fingerprints or my DNA might be on it. So it's not quite as strong as Ms. Yelk Erickson says it is, but doesn't matter. And then she said, the drugs weren't mine. They could have been appellant's. Appellant said, I had no idea the cooler was in the car and I don't know anything about the drugs. So that's the new evidence. The dispute, and it seems like almost the entire dispute here really is about what the appropriate standard of review is. You know this, but juries render general verdicts. We don't ask them what they believe and what they didn't believe. We don't give them special interrogatories. They render a general verdict. The accepted, established, and really indisputable standard of review requires at the first stage of the circumstantial evidence review that you decide what the circumstances proved are. At that stage, all of the evidence is presumed in favor of the state or the guilty verdict. This court, and that's the traditional standard of review. It applies at the first stage of the circumstantial evidence test. And it doesn't operate any differently just because this is circumstantial evidence. This court is still required to presume the jury believed evidence that is consistent with the verdict and disbelieved evidence that is inconsistent with the verdict. And so the idea that I've somehow guessed about what the jury thought or believed, or I'm making things up, that's just nonsense. I'm applying this accepted and settled standard of review, which this court should apply, which is we presume that when the jury heard appellant say he knew nothing about the drugs, they didn't believe it because that's inconsistent with the verdict. They should assume when they heard that Ms. Smith said, the lottery ticket is mine, that is also inconsistent with their guilty verdicts. And this court should presume that the jury disbelieved that evidence. Ms. Yelk Erickson said that because it's a joint possession case, you are required on review, I'm going to try to get this right, to assume everything that Vanessa Smith said is true. I find no authority in the law for that proposition. It's not an all or nothing proposition in any case. As this court has recognized many, many times, a jury can believe parts of a witness testimony and disbelieve other parts of a witness's testimony. The obligation for this court on appeal is to look at the verdict and assume the jury believed what is consistent with verdict, disbelieved what's inconsistent with the verdict. And our Ms. position- Berdorf,
let me just follow up quickly. So in terms of Ms. Smith's testimony that the lottery ticket had been given to her by defendant, that's certainly the fact that his name is on the lottery ticket and his address is consistent, you know, with her statement that he gave it to her. Is it a circumstance proved that she gave that statement in sworn testimony?
Well, she gave this, she said he gave her the ticket. Whether that's a circumstance proved depends on whether the jury credited it. That's how it sort of loops back to the standard of review.
Right, but I think Ms. Yelk Erickson's point is that the jury may have credited it and decided that it was evidence that they jointly possessed the meth in the cooler.
Right, but that actually is speculation. Not speculation is they may have credited it, they may not have credited it. The truth is, and this goes back to what I said about the general verdict, we can't go back and ask the jurors what they thought about that precise piece of testimony. We can't do that. We don't give them special.
So it's not a circumstance proved.
So it is not a circumstance
because we don't know.
because we don't know, and it's actually inconsistent with the jury's guilty verdicts. If the jury truly believed that that lottery ticket was hers and that the defendant didn't know anything about what was in that cooler, the verdict might have looked different. That's how the analysis should go.
But I don't think that's the argument I hear appellant making. They're saying it's consistent with joint possession, so that the jury believed, as you said, they chose to believe some of Ms. Smith's testimony, but not necessarily all of it. And that the, if the lottery ticket is seen as having been given to, which is her testimony, her by the defendant, then that is joint possession. And does that, well, just stop there. Is that the way we look at circumstances proved?
No, because we don't know we're never going to know if the jury believed that particular component of Ms. Smith's testimony. We aren't going to know that. And so what the standard of review requires is the court looks at it, at the evidence, and says, is that consistent with their guilty verdict? And if the answer is no, which it, in my our position is that is inconsistent with a guilty verdict, then the court's obligation is to find that it is not a circumstance proof, that it was her lottery ticket. What is a circumstance proved is that the lottery ticket exists, it was in the cooler, and it has Mr. Anderson's name on it. That's the circumstance proved. So I hope that helps clarify what the state's position is about that particular piece of evidence. I guess I was talking more generally just about how I think we identify the circumstances proved. We don't guess. One of the arguments that's been made is you look at all the evidence anew and you can try to decide whether there's another inference other than guilt. That isn't the test. That's the second component of the circumstantial evidence standard review. And what Ms. Yelk-Erickson has done is she has skipped the first part, which has the unfavorable standard of review to her client's case. You don't get to speculate about whether the jury believed appellant, because the standard of review says if his testimony is inconsistent with the guilty verdicts, then it is not a circumstance proved. And we're asking you just to apply the recognized, accepted, and settled standard of review when you were determining what the circumstances proved are in this case. Hayes is a case that is important here, because once you appropriately determine what the circumstances proved are, and they don't include Vanessa Smith's ownership of that lottery ticket, and they don't include the defendant's testimony where he denies knowing about those drugs, when you exclude those things, there really is no rational inference other than appellant's guilt. A rational inference, and this is what Hayes stands for, cannot be based on testimony that this court must presume has been rejected by the jury rendering their guilty verdicts. So that is why Hayes is important here. I don't want to suggest to the court that we don't think that this could have been a joint possession case. It very well could have been a joint possession case. But the circumstances that were proved are inconsistent. The proximity, the personal effects, defendant's drug possession, and the link to that cooler, and then his subsequent admissions. When you look at all of those things in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, there is no rational inference that Vanessa Smith was the sole possessor of those drugs and that somehow defendant had no knowledge they were in his car. What those pieces of evidence suggest and support, as this court found in 2019, are that Mr. Anderson did consciously exercise dominion and control over the drugs in that cooler, and the state proved that beyond a reasonable doubt. Whether the possession is exclusive or joint, it really doesn't matter. That evidence is compelling evidence. And the Mr. Anderson's testimony and Vanessa Smith's testimony don't change that analysis. So we would ask that you very carefully assess the circumstance proved. And once you do that component of the test, we're confident that the court will affirm the jury's guilty verdicts in this case. Unless the court has other questions or questions about the second issue in the case, We'd rest on our brief for the second issue in the case, and we just ask that you affirm Mr. Anderson's convictions. Thank you.
Sounds like there are no questions from the panel for Respondents' Counsel. Okay, very good. So with that, Ms. Yelk-Erickson, I think we're ready for you to begin rebuttal when the clock is reset, almost there. There we go.
Thank you, Your Honors. I confess, after hearing that argument, I'm somewhat confused. And I think that confusion is intentional. This is a distortion of the circumstantial evidence test designed to get you to affirm this one conviction. I want to make 2 points, and I'm going to attempt to make them clearly. Number one, a fact that respondent did not address at all in this argument, nor argued is not a circumstance proved, is Ms. Smith's conviction, her later actions. Respondent's brief agrees that this is a circumstance proved. So by itself, that fact is significant evidence of her sole possession because she did the same thing 5 months later when Mr. Anderson was not around. In terms of how we evaluate the circumstances proved, we need to know what the defendant is guilty of. What crime are we evaluating? What elements are we checking for? I don't understand that respondent is asserting that somehow this jury found that Mr. Anderson solely possessed these drugs, that Ms. Smith somehow had nothing to do with it, even though the prosecutor's opening statement, closing statement, and the jury instructions invited the jury to find joint possession. To be clear, at no point until argument today has the state of Minnesota ever suggested that the evidence supported a conviction of sole possession by Mr. Anderson. And I would suggest to you that's outlandish. She had 3 bags of methamphetamine on her person. She admitted she touched the cooler and put her planner in there. And I'll address whether or not this is circumstance proved in just a moment. And 5 months later, she's caught in another car with another large baggie of methamphetamine and her mail. The idea that he possessed this by himself is just not remotely supported. What's the other possible theory? Joint possession. That is the only theory the state had at trial. That is the only theory argued to the jury. And respondent seems to acknowledge, well, maybe that's what the jury found, but we don't know. Well, if it's possibly a theory on which the jury found the defendant guilty, then that theory is consistent with the guilty verdict. And this court evaluates the circumstances proved to determine whether or not they are consistent or inconsistent with that guilty verdict, a guilty verdict of joint possession. It seems like the state wants to have it both ways, to be able to not charge Ms. Smith, but yet argue in Mr. Anderson's trial that they jointly possessed these drugs, to say explicitly to the jury in closing argument, we don't have to tell you who possessed them, they both possessed them. To turn around on appeal and now say, we don't even acknowledge that theory and this court can throw it out because it's a mystery what the jury did. That is not how you do the circumstantial evidence test. You look at what is the defendant guilty of? He's guilty of possession. If there are two possible theories, then both are consistent with the verdict. If I said during my principal argument that you should just blindly accept everything that came out of Ms. Smith's mouth when she testified, that was incorrect. I did not mean to say that. What I did intend to say, and what I will say again, is that her testimony that it was her planner, he gave her the lottery ticket as payment, she put them both in the cooler, and she touched the stuff in the cooler. Those are all facts consistent with the verdict. There is no possible jury verdict that happened in this case other than a joint possession verdict. I think any suggestion that you can just throw out joint possession, that you don't need to evaluate it on appeal, is frankly dangerous. That is not what we do. We don't ignore the jury's verdict when the state had multiple options, 2 options. Jury, you can find him guilty of theory one or theory two. And on appeal say, no, court of appeals, you should only look at theory one. There is no reason to do that. There's absolutely no law supporting that proposition. There's not a single case in respondent's brief that says when a defense witness provides testimony consistent with the verdict, that testimony does not count in the circumstances proved. No cases. The Hayes case is about a defendant. I agree. When a defendant testifies and says, I didn't do that, that wasn't me, I didn't do that murder, I didn't beat that person up, I wasn't there. Yes, of course, those aren't circumstances proved. Those are inconsistent with the verdict. That's exactly what Hayes says, and that's all Hayes says. Hayes isn't about a joint possession drug case. Hayes doesn't say that you reject Vanessa Smith's testimony. Her testimony is perfectly consistent with this verdict because the verdict was joint possession. Again, there's really no coherent argument here that Mr. Anderson solely possessed the drugs. I don't see how that's possible on these facts. So all we're left with is joint possession, which is perfectly consistent with the prosecutor's opening statement, the prosecutor's closing statement, and the way the jury was instructed. That is the theory on which you have to determine what the circumstances proved are. And those are facts. Those are not about the jury's disbelief or belief. They're about evidence in the record. There's a reasonable inference from these circumstances proved that Ms. Smith alone possessed the drugs. For that reason, we would ask this court to reverse Mr. Anderson's drug possession convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case as for your arguments today, as well as the briefs that you submitted to the court. This matter is now submitted to us for our decision, and the panel will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe.